This is the podcast for Monday, February 7th, 2011, Theories of Knowledge. And today we're talking about Kant. Everybody looks so excited.
Yeah.
So, Kant, let's say about Kant. A couple of things by way of introduction. One is I think that it's good to look at Kant in the context of Hume. Kant started out as a rationalist and then said he read David Hume and was woken up from his dogmatic slumbers. And so Kant had a sort of a view like Descartes. And after reading Hume, he realized that view was untenable. And so what he does is he creates a kind of a synthesis or a combining of the both of the best elements of both rationalism and empiricism. And comes up with a view which maybe isn't common sense, but at least isn't as crazy as Hume's view, or some people might say as crazy as Descartes' view, but steers a kind of a middle course. And influences philosophy from then on. You have people who are called continentalists who do what's called continental philosophy, people like Hegel and Heidegger and Fichte and some of these other German philosophers primarily who move into phenomenology and existentialism. And then on the other hand, you have people who continue in Kant's vein, and you get British analytic philosophy. And one of the things about Kant is that even though he has this terrible style, he's very precise about definitions and always defines his terms. And he thinks that language is very important. And so you have the linguistic philosophers, people like Bertrand Russell and Carnap and Kripke and all these people who are the forerunners of what's known as Anglo-American philosophy, who also claim Kant as their heir. And so you get Kant sort of being the beginnings of continental philosophy and analytic philosophy. And you can see he actually has elements of both of these philosophies. In German philosophy, it's really important that this distinction between subject and object. And you read German philosophy, it's all about subject and object, object and subject. And almost ad nauseum. You get it even in the German theology, Martin Buber. It's I and thou, and this idea that there's something in the subject which affects how they see the object is really important in German philosophy. And by the time you get to through continental philosophy and existentialism to what's called postmodern philosophy, I can work. So this is a little background on the kind of large philosophical movements we've been spending a lot of time looking at particular philosophers, but I want you to sort of see how you have the empiricists, let's put the rationalists over here, so you have the rationalists on one side, and then you have empiricism on the other. And they both influence Kant, who has a kind of a combination of rationalism and empiricism. And then from Kant, you get all the various schools of philosophy. Continental philosophy claims him as someone who's their philosophical ancestor, but analytic philosophy does too. And so you'll notice in Kant, you see this stress on language and on how important it is to analyze sentences. And notice where Hume talks about the difference between relations of ideas and matters of fact, Kant's talking about sentences. And he's talking about how in an analytic sentence, the predicate is contained implicitly in the subject. Right, so he's analyzing grammar and language and thinks our language is very important in understanding the world. British and American philosophers sort of took off with, and they went down to diagramming sentences, turning them into logical symbols, and trying to come up with the truth of philosophy in that way, which, I mean, in some ways you might see as a turn back towards Descartes. And so you get this emphasis on logical rigor, on logical formalism, and on language in British and American philosophy called analytic philosophy, and then in continental philosophy done on the continent, meaning everywhere except for Britain. So continental philosophy means European philosophy excluding Great Britain. And so continental philosophy, primarily German and French, gets from Kant. You'll notice Kant's very systematic. He uses a lot of jargon and technical terms. It has that, and I think variable style, incomprehensibility. Well, suppose you can't read it to emulate German philosophy. So you read like, I remember reading Hegel in graduate school. And Hegel keeps on talking about spirit and absolute spirit. So I go into the instructor and I'm reading this and I look at all these different passages. I have them all outlined out. And I'm okay, in this context. And I said, well, look, you know, I'm wondering what Hegel means about absolute spirit. And in this context, he seems to mean this. In this other context, so he seems to mean something completely different. And these two meanings seem incompatible. And I look at the instructor and she says, well, yeah, people have noticed that, and there's a lot of different views about what that might mean, and nobody's quite sure what Hegel means by spirit or absolute spirit. Whereas if you read David Hume, for example, he says, by impressions I mean blah 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 blah, right? And by ideas I mean think copies of these used in thinking. You know, impressions are those forceful and lively, vivacious perceptions which are impressed on the individual mind, and whereas ideas are the active ways in which the mind makes copies of these to use in thinking and in memory and so on. And so and the same thing with Kant. You don't read Kant and you don't think, well, what does he mean by this analytic? What does that mean? He says an analytic sentence is one in which the predicate isn't contained implicitly in the subject. And then he gives you some examples in case you don't know. You don't see like rigorous definitions and examples in Hegel or Heidegger. They say, they quote ancient Greek philosophy, and they use terms like being and existence in loose ways and subject and object, and it's always about being and existence, but you're really not sure. And then sometimes you'll get a definition, but it will be a definition in terms of the other jargony, weird ways in which they use words. And so you get people who become experts in, you know, Hegel or Heidegger or some of these other, those are the two biggest offenders in the philosophical world, in my opinion, Hegel and Heidegger. I had a friend in grad school who used to refer to Heidegger as the H word. but you get people who become, they read so much of the German philosophy that they start to think it makes sense and has some application to the real world. And then if you're hanging around with a bunch of other people who are using words like, subject and object, object and subject, being in existence, and are familiar with all this corpus of sacred text, then they share this kind of illusion. It's kind of like being in a religious community. But if you're like an analytic philosopher and you come to sit in a department meeting of a bunch of continentalists, you're like, are these people even doing philosophy? What is this? So, and maybe I'll bring in some Derrida and some Hegel just for last. Anyone take Will Cowling's Philosophy 203 class? Lucky, lucky, lucky. You know, Will's a smart guy, and I admire him for using Philosophy 203. I don't want to speak out of turn. He's a great guy, and his classes are great. And I really like the critical thinking text, but I would not be so brave as to use Heidegger's Introduction to Metaphysics in an introductory philosophy class. Why? Because you read it and you're wondering, What does it say? I don't understand it. And then you have people, I remember in graduate school there were students that thought, oh, if only I knew German, if stuff would make sense to me. And a friend of mine, he actually went over to Germany. I think he was at University of Tübingen or something. He was over in Germany doing like a graduate fellowship. And over there, all the students, they're trying to get the English translations because they hear that they make so much more sense. So, you know, it's not the translation. So I apologize for making you read Kant. I think Kant, unlike a lot of that later German philosophy, if you read him, there's something really important and profound, both in his metaphysics and epistemology and in his ethics as well. But I think particularly in his epistemology, he's really on to something. Whereas Hegel, a lot of these continental philosophers, you spend a long time, like you read The Phenomenology of Spirit by Hegel or Reason and History. And Reason and History, it seems to be some sort of a wacky German nationalism mixed in with a bunch of mysticism, dressed in fancy jargon. And you're thinking, well, this is kind of, is that really what he means? It's kind of trivial. Or obviously false, or you just you try to read something else like Phenomenology of Spirit, and after a while you think give me some Bertrand Russell. I gotta read some Bertrand Russell. I gotta read something that makes. I gotta read the newspaper. I want to put my nose into a logic book just so I can have something that makes some logical sense because it just looks like words on the page. So
as you can tell, I don't think too much of continental philosophy.
And I think that if you can't explain something in a paragraph, it's probably not worth understanding to someone who's of college level learning. Maybe some technical things in the sciences, but I think in philosophy, if you can't explain something in a few short sentences or a paragraph, so that someone just gets the gist of it,
which you can't do, I think, with deconstruction. You can kind of do it with existentialism, I suppose. Postmodern philosophy. It's really tough to
but they want you to read a whole book that's full of this jargon and doesn't explain what any of the terms mean. I think that's not the way to do philosophy. So even if there is something profound there, I think you might better spend your time reading some analytic philosophy where the people at least make an attempt at some philosophical rigor and logical coherence.
And someday maybe I'll write a book on postmodern philosophy called The Emperor Has No Clothes or something. That's sort of one of my back burner projects. Anyway, analytic philosophy, I think even though the linguistic term really comes from Kant, that you also get Plato and Aristotle and in here. We might even put Aquinas in here, sort of medieval philosophy. And also I think the rationalists and empiricists themselves come into analytic philosophy in some ways unfiltered by Kant. So
in some ways I think you can look at ancient philosophy and medieval philosophy, and apart from medieval philosophy, the influence of Christianity, you get analytic philosophy. You get an attempt. Even you look back at the earliest dialogues of Plato, it's all about the quest for a definition, which will give you the essence of a thing. Well, that's analytic philosophy.
Where do you find the ancient version of continental philosophy? Maybe in Taoism,
this sort of incomprehensible mysticism where the Tao that is known isn't the true Tao. You think, well, what does that mean? Or maybe Heraclitus in ancient Greek philosophy. There was a fellow named Heraclitus who wrote in these aphorisms, these kind of cryptic sayings all about the flux and the fire, which has a kind of a continental feel to me. But if you look at most of what was called philosophy, the ancient Greek tradition, the medieval tradition, it's focused on language and logic. And it's focused on trying to come to some sort of systematic understanding of the world. And so I would say that most of philosophy is,
analytic, and then you get this sort of offshoot of people doing something like spinning theories in what's called continental philosophy. And there's a few people. I think Nietzsche is considered to be a continentalist. I mean, I think he has some worthwhile things to say, and he's probably the easiest of the continental philosophers to read. But you try to read somebody like Husserl or some of these other philosophers, and I used to think, like, when I was young, that okay, I'm going to spend a lot of time, and I'm just going to like pour through this book and read a bunch of commentaries and try to figure out what it means. And after a while, I thought this just isn't the best use of my time. So anyway, that's my take on the two. These are the two main schools of philosophy, and American schools will vary. Sometimes they'll have a combination of the two. Sometimes they'll lean one way or the other. I think the University of Oregon sort of has a combination of both. Sometimes the continental philosophers, like when I was at Syracuse, the continental philosophers were all in the English department and the religion department. Whereas the philosophy department saw those things mostly as not really being, you know, real philosophy, and not having sufficient logical rigor. So, but then you have more departments that are other departments that are sort of more hybridized. So let's talk about Kant himself. So Kant has this definition of analytic and synthetic.
Let's start out with Hume, maybe.
So you have,
and this is on a table on
page
151, if you have it.
So you have a priori and a posteriori. And then you have analytic and synthetic.
I'll draw a name up here. Should expand my chart a little bit.
So when you think about a priori truth, what is an a priori truth? Definitions from chapter 1, I believe. Or an a posteriori truth?
A posteriori is dependent on experience.
Right, so this is dependent on experience. An a posteriori truth is one which relies on some sense perception to know that it's true. So sometimes they're referred to as empirical truths. Sometimes they're just called the there's another term for this. So empirical truths, or Hume calls these matters of fact and existence. And so he assumes that when you're learning something from sense experience. And actually, that's sort of the content of the category. I think it's probably helpful to keep that distinct. So an a posteriori truth is one where you have to use your senses to figure out whether it's true or not. It's something that you only know that it's true after having some sense experience. An a priori belief, on the other hand, is independent of sense experience. And an a priori belief or truth, you can have an a priori, something which is a priori false also. But if you're talking about a priori truths, those are truths that you don't have to use your senses to know that they're true, or they don't depend on the senses. So 2 and 2 is 4. Now, you may have had to have some sense experience for your brain to develop to grasp the truth of 2 plus 2 equals 4. But it's not the sort of thing that you learn through doing an investigation of the world. It's something that your brain has the ability to grasp mathematics and abstract truths. And once you understand what numbers are, and once you can count, you can just sort of see that if you add 2 and 2, you get 4. take a simpler case, if you have 1 and 1, you get 2. And actually, that might be one of the ways your brain abstracts. You learn 1 and 1 is 2, and then your brain just says, oh, if 1 and 1 is 2, I bet 2 and 2 is 4. And you just sort of naturally do that. It's just part of our ability to grasp patterns and the relations of ideas. And it's not something you have to learn like an empirical truth. What would be an example of an empirical truth or an a posteriori truth to contrast with that? What's something that you don't just sort of grasp with your mind once you understand it, but you have to use your senses to know whether it's true or not?
Gravity?
Think about gravity is kind of a... Yeah, that might be a good example. So, the idea that objects, fall, which aren't being held up. How about something like something more commonplace? Something that you just don't sort of know once you understand that it's true, or once someone says, like, suppose, and then give an example.
Fire is hot.
That's a good example. So do you know that fire is hot? Like, you might imagine, like, seeing fire for the first time. And Hume talks about this a little bit, If he talks about, what would Adam have known? And if Adam were to see fire for the first time, he might not know that it would burn, that fire burns human flesh, right? You'd have some experience, or what's better, have someone else tell you that fire is hot and it'll burn your hand. If you have a good parent, they're telling you, oh, no, don't touch the hot stove. Or the bad parents are saying, you've been a bad boy. They ran your hand down there on the hot stove and burn it as punishment. Right? So you want the good parent, though, will say, no, fire burns human flesh. Don't touch the hot stove. Don't stick that fork in the electrical socket, Johnny, right? So there's two ways of learning, by experience and, by the wisdom of others. And I recommend learning by experiences is typically less pleasant than learning by example of others. So you have the a priori beliefs, and this is, let's put Hume here. So Hume says all a priori truths are relations of ideas, and these are things like logic, math. How ideas are related to one another, and if it's about concepts or definitions, it's a priori. And then on the other hand, Hume says if you're dealing with a posteriori beliefs, these are all matters of fact and existence. So any truth about the world, which isn't about how ideas or concepts are related to one another, but it's about what exists, those all have to be known to the senses. And then Hume says, there's nothing here and there's nothing here. But if it's an a priori truth, it's not a matter of fact and existence, and it can't be what Kant calls synthetic. And that if it's an analytic truth, something which is known through pure reason, then also he says it can't be known through the senses. So all analytic truths are known through reason, and all synthetic truths are known through the senses. And you can use Kant's relations of ideas and matters of fact and existence roughly parallel what Kant means by analytic and synthetic. Now, Hume defines these in terms of what they concern. Kant defines them linguistically or grammatically. So Hume says relations of ideas, those are how concepts are related to one another. Matters of fact and existence, that concerns what exists, what there is. And whereas Kant says an analytic statement is one where the predicate is contained in the subject.
people can see where the lectern there.
The predicate is contained in the subject.
So you take a statement like, a triangle has three sides. Grammar school grammar. So the subject, a triangle. Predicate has three sides. And the idea is if you understand what a triangle is, you understand
that part of the definition of a triangle is it has three sides. So you see, when I say triangle and then I say, if you know what a triangle is, you understand this is a true sentence. The only way that you would agree with this proposition is if you didn't know what a triangle is. So Kant says that the predicate is contained implicitly in the subject. That a triangle has all sorts of essential properties. A triangle is a planar figure. A triangle, you get some of these. It's a question about whether it's part of the definition or whether it's an attribute of triangle. A triangle has interior angles equal to 180 degrees. That might be kind of a tough one. But at least you can think a triangle is a three-sided planar figure. Is an analytic truth. Now, what might be a synthetic truth about triangles? A triangle appears on every dollar bill in the United States, right? It's the all-seeing eye of Osiris or Horus or whatever it is, right? You have if you pull out a dollar bill, you'll see there's a pyramid on the back. And actually, I suppose you could say it's a pyramid, right? But you can't have a pyramid without a triangle in each base. So a pyramid is a solid figure with triangular faces. Yeah.
What about triangle has straight lines? Is that synthetic?
I think that would be analytic because it's as a three-sided figure, and could the sides be curved? See, so there's a famous paper called The Analytic and Synthetic where basically. This guy Quine just sort of pokes holes in the distinction. So I'm not. It's kind of. There are some cases where it's tough to tell the distinction between what's part of the essence of a thing and what's simply its properties. But I think you can do it to a certain extent in that some things like seem clearly part of the definition of triangles. Other things seem to be truths about the triangle, where the predicate isn't contained in the subject. So if you know what a triangle is. You know that it has three sides. But if you know what a triangle is, you wouldn't necessarily know that a dollar bill has triangular shapes in the back of it, right? That's something you'd have to know through the senses. Like, for example, if you were, if you lived in Zimbabwe and you'd never seen a $1 bill, you've seen a trillion-dollar note in your own currency through hyperinflation, but you haven't seen the back of a dollar bill, which has yet to hit hyperinflation. But who knows? The Federal Reserve is working on it. So you have you would know what was on the dollar bill unless you'd looked on the internet, talked to someone who'd been there. You need some sense experience where someone's looked at a dollar bill and said, okay, yeah, that's this is what's on the back. There's like this pyramid and it includes some triangular shapes. So that's not part of the definition of triangle. So a synthetic definition might be there are triangular shapes on the back of a dollar bill. Dollar bill. Federal Reserve note, to be precise. Used to be backed by gold, now it says in God we trust. So so that's not a truth about triangles. It's not an essential truth about triangles. It's not part of the definition of triangles. It's something that where and actually this is kind of a funny construction if you say there are. Maybe you could put triangles. I just want to make sure the grammar is parallel here. So there's different constructions in English, but you might just say triangles. Triangles. Triangles appear on the back. So that's triangles appear on the back of the US dollar bill.
Take another example. The President of the United States is the commander and chief of the armed forces or military. There's the military. Okay. What's the subject of this sentence?
President.
President. The president. The predicate is commander-in-chief of the military. Is this analytic or synthetic?
Analytic.
Yeah, why is it analytic? You're right, it is analytic.
It's the predicate is containing the definite.
Yeah, it might help to give us, what would be a synthetic example where the president was a subject?
The president is the most powerful man in the world. Would be synthetic.
Controversial claim. But yeah, that might work, right? The president is, and you could add a couple of things. How about the president is Barack Obama? Imagine your crank was frozen, and or maybe you were frozen back in the 60s and you were revived today, and you knew that the president was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces if you were knowledgeable of the Constitution, but you wouldn't necessarily know just by understanding what the president is, who the president was. This is a synthetic truth. It's a truth about the world. It's not a truth about a concept. And so this is the distinction between analytic and synthetic is roughly a distinction between conceptual truths and truths about the world. Put in linguistic form. Oh, the president is the most powerful man in the world. The president of the U.S. Gave away British nuclear secrets to the Russians to get them to sign a peace treaty, right? That's a synthetic truth. So that's the distinction between analytic and synthetic. So when Hume thinks about analytic and synthetic or relations of ideas and matters of fact, and a priori and a posteriori, he says, is it about a conceptual truth? Well, then it's got to be known a priori. Is it a truth about what exists? It's got to be a posteriori. Either it's known, because then this makes intuitive sense, right? Conceptual truths, those are grasped through reason. And they're not
that's
really...
analytic. Sorry. That's yeah. Analytic.
Yeah, so conceptual truths or analytic truths, those are grasped through reason. Because they're about how ideas and concepts are related to one another. So in order to find out how ideas and concepts are related to one another, you don't have to, go out there and do some investigation. You just close your eyes and think about how things are related to one another the way Descartes thought you could do philosophy. If you're wondering about a matter of fact in existence, do you close your eyes and think, does a coffee cause a heart disease? Okay, well, think of the concept of coffee, and it's kind of bitter, and but it smells really good when it's cooking. You think of all the properties of coffee, it makes me feel kind of excited. And people when they have heart attacks, they can be kind of their heart kind of goes kind of haywire, and so you're trying to think, well, does it stress? I think the concept of stress. And you're thinking of all these concepts. But how do you find out if coffee, contributes to heart disease? Could you figure it out just by thinking about how coffee tends to make you excitable or it makes your heart beat faster and maybe it might wear out? And no, that it turns out that they've done studies and coffee is actually good for you in moderation.
You know, I'd be like this friend of mine. He said he went to the doctor and he complained of tremors in his hand. And the doctor asked if he drank a lot of coffee. His line is just like two a day or something like that. And the doctor said, well, that can be the cause then. And just two cups a day isn't going to do anything. And he said, oh, no, two pots. So two pots of coffee is not good for you, right? But now what they've done is they've done studies, right, empirical investigation that shows that people that drink coffee actually get some benefit. It's improved circulation, improved mood, and you know, stress and depression are one of the causes of heart disease. So there's all sorts of evidence that coffee in moderation is actually good for you and even good for your heart. But you can only know that, you can't do that by just closing your eyes and think about coffee, right? So that it makes intuitive sense. Kant will agree with this somewhat, but he wants to make some adjustments. And some of the most important adjustments is Kant now. So Kant says relations of ideas, logic, okay. But Kant says, I want to X this out here. Kant says mathematics is synthetic. So he wants to put this here. Sorry, get my categories in step. A priori.
We're going to synthetic to that.
doing this church, trying to do this. So it goes the way I have it in the book. Where does math go?
In synthetic right there.
Over here. I think in the past, sometimes I move my, I have the analytic and synthetic going down the side. So math is a priori synthetic, or the synthetic a priori. Kant refers to it, and I have in the book. So the synthetic a priori includes mathematics. Why isn't mathematics an analytic analytic? Well, Kant's doing this grammatically, right? So he has this idea that you have like sentence 12 is 6 plus 6. Is that an analytic or synthetic statement?
Synthetic.
Why is it synthetic? Here's a predicate, here's the subject, here's the predicate. Isn't this contained in this?
Yeah, but 5 and 7 could also be contained in that.
Yeah, so there's also 5, 7, how about 13 minus 1, 48 divided by 4. There's an infinite number of predicates that apply to this subject. So therefore, it's not synthetic. Yeah, sorry, it's not analytic, it's synthetic. But it's still a priori. So Kant says mathematics is not empirical. It's about how concepts are related to each other. It's not something that you learn or verify through the senses. But on the other hand, it's known through pure reason. It's not it's a priori synthetic, or synthetic a priori. It's something which is a significant truth about the world, but it's known through pure reason. And Kant wants to put some other things in here too. And he actually agrees that there's nothing here. And here he has the presuppositions of science. And most importantly, every event has a cause. So remember, Hume says we can't know that every event has a cause. And Hume says that we shouldn't believe in cause and effect. It's just this psychological expectation that things, patterns of the past, or can continue in the future. Since you can't prove that empirically, so much the worse for cause and effect, get rid of it. Kant says, since you can't prove empirically, or a posteriori, that there is such thing as cause and effect, you must know it a priori, or through reason. Because you do know it. So in this way, Kant wants to be the friend of common sense in a way that Hume isn't. Hume says empiricism comes first, common sense comes second. And this is why he gets this crazy view that all there are ideas kind of floating around in bundles and and there's just ideas and we can't prove anything else, and everything is ideas and the relations of ideas. You don't even have a mind. Why is that? Well, it's because Hume is an empiricism, or empiricist, and he takes empiricism seriously. And he's not willing to make concessions to common sense. When there's a conflict between common sense and empiricism, he goes with empiricism. And so Kant says it's crazy to think there's no such thing as cause and effect. So in this way, he accepts a kind of rationalist intuition. He says, yeah, we do know that there's such thing as cause and effect. We can't prove it empirically, therefore we must know it through reason. And so but then the question is that just sort of like a trivial truth about how concepts are related to each other? And I think the answer is no. And if you contrast two statements, every effect has a cause, and every event has a cause. So, which one of these statements is analytic? Are both? Neither?
Sir.
One but not the other?
Every effect is analytic.
Yeah, every effect has a cause. What is an effect?
A result.
A result of a cause. What is a cause? That which produces an effect, right? So these two terms relate to each other in a pretty clear way. So has a cause is part of the definition of an effect. An effect is just that which is produced by a cause. But if you think about the concept of an event, is it true by definition that every event has a cause? Well, Kant would say no, but he still thinks it's true. It's just that it's a substantial fact about events that they do have causes, but it's not part of the concept of an event. Because you ever have someone say, you know, why did this happen? And people say, I don't know, it just sort of happened, or no reason. Right? There's people will you can imagine in your mind that something happened for no reason. Now, if you're going to be a scientist and you notice some new weird phenomenon, like you're looking at a star and it's like wobbling, and you're like, well, why is it wobbling? If you're like a scientist, you don't say, well, maybe it wobbles for no reason at all. It just sort of wobbles, and that's the end of it. Right? And scientists want to find out the causes of things. Well, to find out the causes of things presupposes that there is a cause. And so to be a scientist means to assume that every event has a cause. Again, you can't prove it empirically. You can't prove it with the senses. You must know it through reason. And so this is analytic, but this is synthetic. And this is what you need to do science. You need to know that every event has a cause, because you're looking for causes. That's what science is about. You're trying to figure out why stuff happens the way it does. And you're trying to come up with a complex explanation which accounts for all the data. Or actually, you're looking for the simplest explanation possible for complex phenomena. To be a scientist means to assume that every event has a cause. Now, you can't prove it. Again, you can't prove it through the senses. You have to know it through reason. So this is why Kant thinks that this category, the synthetic a priori, is really important. Some other examples of synthetic a priori truths would be like that the world is pretty much the same everywhere you look, that it's homogeneous. That if you find some copper in one part of the earth, you dig it up, and it conducts electricity, then under the same conditions, it will conduct electricity if you dig up copper from some other part of the world. The copper pretty much works the same. The laws of electromagnetism work the same. And again, without those assumptions, you couldn't do science. This is like if you're trying to put a man on the moon, right? You say, well, okay, I understand the way gravity works, like on the Earth, is such and such. And all these experiments we've done on the Earth show that if we have this certain trajectory with a certain force, then, and with the gravitational force of the moon, if we do these complex calculations, then this should land our capsule on the moon. But if nobody's ever been to the moon, how do you know gravity works on the moon the same way it does on the Earth? Right? Kant would say that you need to presuppose that it does in order to make those calculations and then do it. And then, of course, you know, scientifically, Kant would say if you get some data and it turns out that your experiment doesn't work and the capsule goes off into space and you checked all your calculations, you might be open to the possibility that things might be a little different in certain cases, like the first few moments of the Big Bang, or inside a black hole, maybe the laws of physics break down. But you have to make this assumption of uniformity. Otherwise, you can't do science. And that's sort of part of the idea of cause and effect, right? In order to know that you should expect a typical effect, you have to know that your antecedent conditions are the same as in other cases where you produce that effect. And that requires a kind of assumption of uniformity of the world. Comments or questions so far? It's kind of heady stuff. So on the exam, you should remember the synthetic a priori, the most important category for knowledge. Synthetic a priori. Truths which are significant truths about the world, which are known through pure reason, not the senses. And truths that you need to prove things in the sciences, or to even do science, and to avoid becoming a nut like Berkeley or Hume, because empiricism, according to Kant, is a dead end, just like rationalism was a dead end. He said, with rationalism, you put the rationalist against Hume, and you realize it's an untenable position. I think Hume said, or Kant said, if you like Descartes, and then you read Hume, you realize that Descartes is his philosophy is bankrupt. But then he says, if you're a whole hog empiricist, you're going to end up with a nutty view like Hume's. And so, while he saw that Hume showed problems with rationalism, he wasn't ready to embrace empiricism wholeheartedly because it led to these absurd conclusions. And so his idea was kind of dial back empiricism a little bit and try to figure out, well, okay, maybe most of the time you should require empirical data, but are there things that we know through reason, through, you might say, rational intuition? And that would be the synthetic a priori truths. And so, in a way, it's just kind of going back to Locke, and that Locke says, well, you know, you can't imagine qualities existing disembodied, so we just sort of assume there's a real world. And I think this is similar to Kant's view that you have to sort of posit a real world of matter, posit cause and effect, posit uniformity, and that those are rational things to posit, and you're justified in believing those things, and then the rest of the time you use your senses to try to figure stuff out. Now, is Kant a direct realist then? This would be one question. Or does he seem to be a representationalist? Well, let's talk about these two terms, noumena and phenomena. What's the difference between noumena and phenomena? Phenomena. Phenomena is the world of human experience. Noumena is the real world as it is apart from human experience. So Kant talks about the fact that when you experience the world, you're not experiencing it as it is, you're experiencing it as a human being. And so as you're experiencing the world as a human being, your act of perception and conception is adding stuff that's not really there. The problem is, as a human being, you can only perceive and conceive in certain ways because of the way your brain works, because of the way your senses work. And so you're locked into that. So there's no way for you to kind of jump out of your skin unless you're having like a, you know, out-of-body experience or something, or near-death experience, and see, okay, well, here I'm perceiving without a body, without senses, and without senses, and without a brain, and does this match up with what I perceive when I'm embodied? All that might be interesting, that you know, out-of-body epistemology, it might be an interesting topic for a paper. But you think about normally that you can't jump out of the human mind and see whether the human mind perceives things differently than, say, God would perceive them. And so Kant says it's important to recognize, though, that the way we perceive the world isn't the way it really is. So we perceive this table as solid. But physics says that it's made up of, the latest physics theory says it's made up. So, you know, strings vibrating in 11-dimensional hyperspace. Right? That's sort of the current theory. Or if you want to take the particle model, it's, you know, particles of matter, but mostly empty space. And, you know, protons, neutrons, electrons, and particles orbiting at fantastic speeds. And, you know, I don't see anything moving there. It looks like it's still. But in reality, I'm not perceiving the fact that this is made up of all these microphysical particles that are whirling around, vibrating, and doing all these various things. It's just that from my macro perspective, it looks like it's solid, when in reality, it's mostly empty space. So this is going back to all these arguments for representationalism over direct realism. And so Kant says, if you take representationalism seriously, you realize that almost nothing of what we perceive is the way the world actually is. And there's no way for us to ever know the way the world actually is. So someone like Locke, he recognizes the problems with like color, that the reason we see color is we have color receptors. But Locke is a realist about things like shape and size and extension and solidity and density. He thinks those things are pretty much the way we perceive them. And, you know, space and time and all those things, he's kind of common sense. He just thinks there's a few cases like color perception where we have recognized that human beings perceive things that may not be a part of the real world, and that there's this kind of microscopic structure which underlies our perception of things, and maybe there are these hidden springs and principles that we're not aware of. But Locke wants to go pretty much along with the representationalist picture that our mind sort of accurately copies the world and creates these sensations which represent it pretty much, you know, the way it is, apart from some exceptions. Kant wants to say that all perception is like seeing color, that even our perception of shape and size and dimension, the way we break things up, the way even our concepts of material object versus quality are part of the way the human mind categorizes things. And so we tend to think about like this this cup, and I can sort of think abstractly. I think, well, the cup is purple, and the cup's color is different from its shape. And I think about it as an object with certain properties, right? It holds liquid, and it's has a certain weight, and it makes a certain sound when I wrap on it. It's solid. But if you think about it, in reality, is there any distinction between the cup and its properties? No. Substance and properties, Kant says, is a way we think about objects. But humans think about objects. It's the way we think about the world, right? In terms of substances and their properties or qualities. But there is no distinction in reality between substance and quality. That's just the way we understand the world. In the same way, if you think about, like, you know, how many objects are there in this room, for example? Just like a ballpark guess. So how many things are there in this room?
A couple hundred.
Okay, anybody think more, less? More, how many? Like, 1,000?
Are these counting the non chairs or just the chairs?
Oh, good question. Are we going to count all the chairs? All the things in the backpacks. How many objects is this?
Yeah, I mean, is it built? Are you counting components, right? Or just?
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Is a hair an object? A single hair?
How about all the cells inside the hair?
Right. Yeah.
How about all the molecules inside the cells, inside the hair? So Kant would say that it's an ambiguous question because it depends on how you split up things. And that's a kind of arbitrary way. You could imagine thinking about the world in terms of processes instead of objects. Right? We have this concept of process, and we understand that a process of a certain sort creates like a stable object. So you have the idea of a river. You have the sort of channel in the ground, and you have water flowing through it, and or you have the idea of fire, right? Combustion. You might think about objects as sort of flowing with particles of matter coming in and out of them. Instead of thinking about objects, thinking about processes and their flows or something. So there might be different ways metaphysically of thinking about the world apart from object and qualities. And Kant says that you need to recognize that it's not just the way you perceive the world, not just through your eyes and your ears and your sense of taste and smell, but it's the way you think about the world is also a facet of the human mind. And so this is what he means when he talks about noumena, which is the thing in itself, the world as it actually is, versus phenomena, which is the way it appears to human beings, the way human beings see it and think about it. And what Kant says is that we can never get to the noumena. So what we should do is have a science of phenomena, a science of appearances, if you will. And so by the time you get to Kant says the dream of the philosophers is an impossible dream. You can never pierce the veil of appearances to get to reality. But that's okay. So you finally can recognize that there's no way to get to reality in itself. But you can nevertheless know things indirectly about reality, and you can know about the way human beings experience reality. And by abstracting principles from the way human beings experience reality, you can come up with some truths about reality itself. But basically, Kant wants to have a science of appearances, a science of the phenomena of the world as humanly experienced. But he says, this doesn't mean I'm a skeptic, because you need to lower the bar a little bit. So it's sort of like if you give a test and everybody fails the test, you say, well, you know, everyone fails and that's it. Now Kant would say, you should throw out the test, it's too hard. So in the same way, Kant says, look, if you're trying to figure out the truth about the essence of the world, you're never going to figure it out. Because human beings just aren't able to do that. We're locked into a human nature with a certain kind of brain, a certain kind of mind, certain kinds of perceptions. So what we need to do is have a science of perceptions or a science of the phenomenal world and realize there is a numinal world, just that we can never get to it. And so we should content ourselves with knowledge of the phenomenal world, and we're going to call that knowledge. And that's how you solve the problem of skepticism, is by adding a curve, as it were, to epistemology. So we can never know noumena or the world in itself. We can only know the way human beings perceive it. Now this kind of is seen as a kind of a giving up by some philosophers. I know Ayn Rand hated Kant. She thought he was the source of all the philosophical problems and errors of the world, because people take the sort of Kantian idea and they kind of ran with it, and Kant led to this postmodern philosophy where everything's relative and nothing is true and everything is true and what's true is determined by who's in political power. But I think that the postmodernists really are doing something different from what Kant was doing. And Kant wasn't, you know, a skeptic in the sense that some of these postmodern philosophers were, and he wasn't a relativist in the sense that some of these later philosophers were. He just recognized that there's no way to jump out of your skin and jump out of your mind and see, okay, here's the world as it is, here's the way my mind perceives it, do the two match up? That you're essentially connected with the way your mind works and the way your brain works and the way your senses work, and that changes the content of your consciousness. And so we can make some generalizations about how human beings perceive the world, and maybe some know that there is a real world, and that it causes these certain sensations, but we can never know the real world in itself. You do get, in the 20th century, the direct realism was kind of a reaction to the Kantian skepticism about knowing reality in itself. So they go the other way and say, well, look, I can know reality itself. Here's a hand, here's a hand. And G.E. Moore's direct realism. And this is, this isn't like an early movement. The direct realism is a 20th century reaction to Kant, to the idea that we can't know reality in itself. Comments, questions, objections? Anything about Kant? If there are any more terms to know. Kant on the self. It's actually the last thing to do. Kant on the self. So Kant's view of the self is similar in that he thinks that you need to presuppose a thinking subject in order to make sense of our experience. So if you think about the way the mind uses memory and perception and logic to form new conclusions about the world, you'll see that a bundle of perceptions couldn't really learn anything. A bundle of perceptions couldn't learn from experience. Hume's idea of the self is just sort of what's going on in your mind right now. And, the perceptions come and go, and they're associated in certain ways. And, you have a perception of, the apple cinnamon buns cooked in the oven, and that, it seems it becomes related to a new perception comes in, memory of, mom baking apple pie when you were a kid or something. And so you have all these things, coming and going in your mind, and it's sort of like being in an awful, awful James Joyce novel, where it's just sort of stuff's coming in, coming out, it's not really related to each other, it's kind of stream of consciousness. It's like if you're in therapy and your therapist is a Freudian, you're playing the word association game, and he says ball, and you say Super Bowl, and then he writes this very interesting and writes down, and it's just like this ideas associated in certain ways, and that's all there is to you. But Kant says that's nonsense. If you think about a mind is an ordered system of information. The mind's learned. And mind's taken new information and categorize it and synthesize it. And you rely on past experience and background knowledge to form new conclusions based on new data. So Kant says that Hume's view just doesn't make any sense. And so he comes back to this idea of substantial self, which is the actor in thinking, the thinking thing of Descartes is back again. So again, that you might see that as Kant sees the self, the thinking subject, as a presupposition of reason. That there's the distinction between subject and object, between the thinking subject and the object of thinking. I think that's about all I got for you today. So, we knock up a little early on Wednesday. I believe we have a test that's opening up on Wednesday, and so I'll be doing reviewing for the exam. Bring any questions on any of the empiricists or Kant, and that's what we'll be doing on Wednesday.